When supporting a loved one with feeding differences, it's easy to feel like you are alone. At Feeding Matters, our hope is for you to find the community, resources, and support that you need. Through our Power of Two parent-to-parent mentoring program, parents in need of support are matched with one of our volunteer family coaches who have lived experience with their own child and can offer emotional support, resources, and guidance to lessen the isolation that families face with pediatric feeding disorder, or PFD, as well as avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, or ARFID. Families can request a one-time phone call or a three-month or six-month match by filling out the request form on our website. A family coach will make contact via email first, and then by phone or text message, typically within 2 to 3 days. For more information, please contact us at 623-242-5234, extension 306, or email at info@feedingmatters.org. You are not alone.
Presented by Feeding Matters, with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom. Feeding Does Matter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Feeding Does Matter. I'm Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
And I'm Haley Estrom. I'm an associate professor in the School of Nursing at UNC Wilmington. How are you today, Jacqueline?
I'm doing well, Haley. If you hear any interruptions, it's because I have my six-year-old Charlie home with me who just graduated kindergarten yesterday. So yesterday I was all in my feels and today is like very focused work day.
Yeah. Graduation season.
Yeah. We have a guest today and we might as well just get right to him. Speaking of Charlie, I was telling Charlie that I'm going to be speaking with a gentleman named Olaf, like Frozen. So Olaf, I'm sure you get that like comparison all the time. But we are speaking with Olaf Krostek-Margo. Did I say it right, Dr. Camargo? Perfect. And Dr. Camargo is a internationally respected developmental pediatrician and researcher, but welcome. And is it okay if I call you Olaf or would
that's
you prefer?
That's totally fine. Okay. I go by Olaf.
We can edit or switch out. Yeah.
Yeah. And being a pediatrician, it is really helpful. I have a little Olaf plushie
at my
door.
Yeah, I bet you get automatic buy-in from your clients. So.
Yeah. So that's an asset. It Wonderful. Came late in life in my career, but I still
take it. Yeah.
I take it.
Yeah, for sure. So Olaf, maybe share a little bit about yourself, just in general, to introduce yourself to our audience.
So I'm a developmental pediatrician. That means I subspecialized within pediatrics on the topic of children with a variety of developmental issues and difficulties. That range from children with rare syndromes, diseases, children with cognitive issues, with behavioral issues, with physical issues. So it goes through all the different areas. And I had a long journey until I got here where I'm now. I'm here now in Hamilton, Ontario, in Canada, at McMaster University. And I continue practicing, seeing children in our university hospital in the outpatient clinic. It's a center called the Ron Joyce Turner's Health Center. And on the research part, I am the co-director of CanChild, which is the Center for Childhood Onset Disability Research here at McMaster University, which is a small center with a large reach. We have just finished our annual report, or just compiling data for our annual report, and did some internet analysis, and we are one of the most accessed websites in the world related to the topic of childhood onset disability. So we're proud of that.
Very proud of that. That's a huge accomplishment.
And the work with CanChild is very much very close to the ICF, and that's something you wanted to talk with me about today.
Yes. So I forgot to mention it in your introduction, but we found Olaf because of the ICF work, and you just have such deep expertise in this area, and kind of like such a voice for it in terms of sharing it with the world. So maybe, yeah, maybe share a little bit about what even is, when we say ICF, what that even means.
Yeah. Yeah. So I remember I received an email from Praveen Godet, the gastroenterologist that works with Feeding Matters for many years. And out of the blue, he asked me if I would be interested in collaborating with my knowledge about the ICF to a consensus paper about pediatric feeding disorder. And that was the start of our journey together. I think Jacqueline wasn't even pregnant at that time.
You, that was pre-kids.
Right? It was,
yeah.
A long time
ago. Yeah, that was
ago.
Definitely pre-kids.
And so ICF is an acronym that stands for International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health. It is published by the WHO and is this year turning 25, that classification system. Oh. So there, I will have a talk on Saturday celebrating the 25 years, 25th anniversary of the ICF. And it is a classification system that was developed to complement another classification system that people are usually more know more about, called the ICD, which is the International Classification of Diseases. And you could argue why two classifications and why does the WHO do that? And for that, one must understand that the classification of diseases originated, I don't know exactly when, but before World War II, and was mainly meant as an instrument to understand what are the reasons for mortality across different countries. So that was the main issue. So you want to know, okay, how many people die of accidents? How many people die of cancer? How many people die of myocardial infarct and so on? And that has been... hi, Charlie. Hi, I'm Olaf. I actually do have an Olaf here, you see?
Oh, there's Olaf. There's Olaf.
That's my tool for my virtual consult. So the ICD was updated constantly, and then it was a good tool to identify, for example, the impact of vaccinations. So you could see, okay, how many kids have measles, and do we get rid of measles or not, and so on. So that is it is an important tool. But now we are in a time where we still have, unfortunately, many fatalities and many mortal conditions, but the majority of patients nowadays lives with chronic health conditions. So it is not so informative to know how many people have diabetes or how many people live with a stroke or how many people live with or are ex-premature babies, for example. What we want to know is how good is their life? How are they doing?
How do they live? Yeah.
And what matters for their life? And there, that generated the idea that we need a different type of classification that describes what we call functioning. So that's why the ICF has the F. The other letters that they put in about functioning is the main aspect of that. And to describe functioning, researchers were met from across the world with WHO, and they were from all types of fields, both of healthcare, but also of social sciences, of educational sciences. There were representatives of disability groups and so on, advocates, patient advocates, to define, okay, what do we understand by functioning? How can we describe how somebody is functioning? Beyond so when I first heard the word functioning, it sounded very mechanistic, like it's like the engine is functioning well. But functioning in health is more than that. And so what they came up with is that it is a complex system. It's not something that you say or you are functioning or not functioning. It's a it's a spectrum from little functioning and better functioning. Like Haley and I use glasses, so without glasses we wouldn't function as well for seeing and reading or driving. With glasses we can function fine. So how do you describe that? And so the ICF is a system where you have different domains. So you have the domains that are very specific for health and healthcare, that are the body function structures. So you have the ability to describe, okay, which functions are impaired in the body. But then you also describe what are you able to do. So these are called the activities. What do you do with your body and the functions that you have? And then you describe not only what you do, but how do you participate in life with these activities? How are you engaged in life? And all of that happens within a context. And that context is both your own context, like we all bring out our own context with us. Like you might hear my accent is German. I was born in Germany. I grew up in Brazil. These are things I cannot change. That is just the context that makes me a person. So these are the personal factors. And then there's the context that is around you. Where do I live? Here, there's snow in the winter. If I had a mobility issue, snow might be an issue for me. So all these environmental factors are also necessary to describe functioning. And then they, from that structure, then they expanded and described all the different elements. And there are, I think, 1,600 different codes and ways to describe functioning, so that you can basically describe any type of person. Anybody can be described with the ICF and their level of functioning. So the ICF is meant as a complement to the ICD. And what was really exciting in working with Feeding Matters is to apply this concept to one aspect of functioning, which is feeding or eating. That is one action that you need the body be intact. You need certain body functions to be intact. You need to be able to chew, to suck, to swallow, to digest, to metabolize, all these aspects. But then you also have your own personal history. How were you born? Were you traumatized by a tube feeding experience? And you have your environment around you, or the people that trying to feed you, that have their own experience and their own expectations. So to describe feeding in that sense is much more complex than just a swallowing study, for example, can describe. And that was really exciting to work with you guys and to come up eventually with a consensus statement that I think is the first clear diagnostic term. So we come back to the ICD, like having a diagnostic term like pediatric feeding disorder, but totally informed by that perspective of the ICF.
I wondered if it was the first that kind of looked at like that, the building the bridge between like the ICD and the ICF. And I think it's honestly, it seems to have sometimes confused people a little bit of like how in depth it is, but then other people buy in almost instantly. And mm-hmm. I think it all comes back to function. And so when we do introduce the different domains of pediatric feeding disorder to families, a lot of times they understand it because they're thinking about it through a functional lens.
Yeah.
Maybe talk to me a little bit about as we, because actually I'm going to go back. So historically, Olaf, we were in the consensus meeting for pediatric feeding disorder, and there was a big conversation around the push to make it in this like ICF realm. And it was a discussion of like, and we were in the room with a lot of, primarily North American based providers, a lot of healthcare professionals who have kind of a very specific look at something, not always like a system or dynamic system view of mm-hmm. something, which I think it takes to think about this framework. But they all bought in because they understand that like feeding needs function. And we were all there to get a language across disciplines, a language across parents and caregivers and patients. So when we think about needing that, they had that meeting, and that's when Praveen was like, okay, we need to go after Olaf. And then Olaf, you came in and really helped us like kind of take the work that had been done at that meeting and rethink about it using your expertise in the ICF. When you talk about that the ICF is really based in function, I think that's a huge conversation happening in feeding. How do you apply that to feeding, especially as your role as developmental pediatrician and the role that you've had in different treatment and assessment and management of feeding disorders?
I think if you, first of all, I think there are many people who did have that systemic view already without knowing it, right?
So yeah, sometimes that's true. I don't want to discount what was in the room.
if you give a framework to people, then it makes it easier for them to justify what they are doing anyways, right? But it, so yes, as an example, if I was talking about environmental factors being the person that is feeding, right? That is an environmental factor for the child that has a feeding disorder. So people would identify that and would say, well, I need to support these parents with whatever it is, giving more information or calming them down or telling them don't listen to your in-laws or whatever it is, right? But you would think about these things, but then you would be hampered in saying, well, is that my role? Because I am just a speech pathologist. I'm just an OT. I am just a pediatrician. Who am I to talk about how these parents should deal with the other issues in their home? I can just diagnose the weight and I can do blood work and see there is a nutritional deficiency. And so, but how do I do that? You identify the need, but you don't feel authorized to be active on it. Once you have a framework like the ICF, you say, well, that is important. That is as important as the food that we are giving, as the timing of the feeding, as this, all that is important. And it justifies or yourself being, if you have the expertise to provide that type of counseling, or even to invite other professionals to be part of the team to do that part and observe and give advice in that realm. And I think that is the great benefit of having that framework and having that type of diagnosis described in that way, that now the next step, that's something that I heard more than I'm living it, because I live in Canada and we have a different healthcare system, but it is often an issue. How do you justify the cost for an additional professional to be involved in that field? If you think about, okay, this is just a GI problem, why do you need a social worker? Or why do you need a psychologist? Or why do you need, well, you need it because there are issues that are they are affecting the feeding. And if we really want to focus on feeding as a functioning issue, we need to address all these different aspects. And they need to be paid for, obviously.
Yeah. And that's, I think, speaks to language. And Haley and I talk a lot about language on this podcast, too, of like, in order to effectively communicate across disciplines, across families and parents and caregivers and patients, like, we all kind of need to generally understand what everybody is saying and that we're all kind of coming to the table. And I think that's what it did as well, is really help that communication happen. And that's such an aspect of that as well.
Can I just add one more thing to that?
Yeah, add anything, Olaf.
So one thing that has also changed, I spoke that there are people who see that and work like that and understand that. But there had also been people that would say, well, I gave them everything I know. I did all my assessments. I told them what they need to feed. I told them all the strategies. It's still not working. You blame them. It's their fault because I told them what to do and they're not doing it. So it's their fault. So you simply blame. And we call that in medicine often non-compliance. And non-compliance is a very harsh word. It's like you're not obeying what I'm telling you to do.
No, and, it's got a lot of weight.
But if you have that different systemic view, then there is not a non-compliance. You might not be getting everything. You might not have a complete
there's a
picture
missing
of
element.
What you're missing something, but that's why it's not working. But it's not that somebody is not doing what they should be doing. And that is also a change in how we interact with patients and families as well.
Yeah, and I do think it helps reduce a lot of the blaming conversations or the onus sitting just with a parent or a caregiver. Because I think maybe traditionally we think about, oh, maybe the parent didn't tell me this or this. But if you are thinking about it from that broad lens, it's also on you to ask some of the questions to make sure you have the full picture. Or if you are missing something, it's really more of that collaborative care that we hope to see.
There's probably something else that's making it unsustainable for them.
So you really helped reframe pediatric feeding disorder using the ICF. What was any memories that you have of that time? Because you also came out during conference and got to meet a lot of our community. And it was so great because we did a brainstorm with you on like what we need to be doing for the field. What any memories that you want to share that you have of that time? And then I have another follow-up question after that.
You might want
besides
to cut
being
that
at Top
later.
Golf.
That's what I.
I knew that's what you were going to say.
I'm at Top Golf.
Yeah.
Well, part of it is bonding. If we're going to have everybody work together, we need to bond.
And that was great. It was a great activity. I don't remember exact thing because it's a long time, but what
a long time ago.
Like more the feeling that I had is there was a lot of agreement and understanding, like, yeah, that's the way we think as well. It's just, we just didn't have the words for it, but now we have the ICF and that fits how we think and how we understand feeding issues in children and how we want to address them. And, so I felt a great receptivity of the ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. It was giving language to something that we didn't have the words for in a way that like helped us reframe and work better together, for sure. And so then as it came out, I know it took, so after all of that stuff, it took a while to get everything out the door and the publication out there. What has been your sense or what have you seen in terms of how maybe the publication happened and then people accepting the framework? Tell me a little bit about your thoughts and perspectives on kind of the post-publication.
So I don't have like, I cannot say the people accept. I can only say about our own environment here. From the publication, for me, it is my most cited paper.
It's got huge citation numbers.
It is really used a lot. So I think nowadays anybody that speaks about feeding issues or publishes about it cites that paper. I think in our own field, in our hospital, in our clinic, it helped to also invite others to a feeding team that haven't been part before. So things have changed again, more due to financial restraints, but the understanding is there that this is something that needs a multidisciplinary team. We did not have a dietitian, and it was a dietitian was added. We didn't have nursing, and a nurse was added to the team. Psychology was already part of the team, so we had a eating and feeding team before the paper was published already, and tried already to combine different professions out of a way how our system is organized is by different programs for different types of disabilities. So we had a program for children with motor disabilities and a program for children with autism and behavioral concerns. And children in both groups had feeding issues. And we said, well, how can we learn from each other? And in the motor team, people were more focused on, oral motor skills and all these. And in the autism team, people were more focused on the sensory aspects of it. But both could learn from each other. So that's how we put together the eating and feeding consult team that we called it. But we didn't have a dietitian. We didn't have a nurse in it. And these were things that were added later on. Unfortunately, now it's downsized again due to cuts. But yeah, I think the understanding is there. Like among the professionals, that understanding is there.
So the mindset shift happened, and now we just got to kind of figure out what's the maybe most cost effective and efficient way to really support families in it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think everybody is seeing that across. I mean, definitely in the United States, but also in different countries too, of like, what are the like changes? Cause we saw a huge thing happen, you know, kind of post COVID, a lot of program shifts happened and a lot of that stuff. And then it just never really, it just almost felt like it kept getting worse instead of just better kind of after COVID. So I think in terms of like where you see it going, what do you think is needed next? Because I think we had the paper come out. Apologies if you hear Charlie in the background. we had the paper come out, and then we also pursued the diagnostic code in the United States, and we try to encourage other countries to do the same thing. It's not always like well accepted in other countries, or their process looks a little bit different. But we try to tell people that that's okay, because the framework still is very much existing, and it does, you may not need the diagnosis code depending on how your country is set up.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe share a little bit about either the pursuit of diagnosis code and even kind of the chapter we wrote together in your book, and then maybe how does that bring us into the future too?
Yeah, I think the diagnostic code here is not that relevant because it is a different type of billing and so on. I shared with you before, where I see it going more is that it opened up the perspective to focus on different types of outcomes. And then referring to, we're running a study now in our neonatal follow-up clinic. And within the neonatal follow-up community, which I'm only peripherally involved with, but from what I hear from the colleagues there, is that they are also going through a mind shift in what are important outcomes for ex-preemies. And for decades, we were focusing mostly on survival rates and then diagnostic codes like cerebral palsy, intellectual disability, autism, and so on. But when and there's a group here in Canada with parents that participate in research for neonatal follow-up.
I was actually going to bring that up. Would love for you to talk about that.
And the parents were then asked, okay, what are the issues that you are worried about and that you struggle with and that we should address in the routine visits in a neonatal follow-up clinic? Because usually these routine visits were meant to identify which kid has CP early on, which kid has autism early on. The parents told the researchers, well, we are worried about feeding, about sleeping, about emotional regulation, these types of things. And are they more common in our kids than in other kids or not? And we don't know. And how do you address them? And how do you, that's the thing that we want to understand more. And that's why we're now focusing more. And the first thing that was focused on is feeding, because there we have a very good framework, and we have the way how to address it and how to, and we are using the questionnaire that Feeding Matters offers to identify very early on these feeding issues and then be able to counsel parents accordingly to avoid that chronification of feeding issues that we often see, like kids that are 6-7 years old and are still just not biting anything, just liquid food. And you want to avoid that.
Yeah.
And that's a much more meaningful outcome, I think, for many parents than what we have been focusing on before. They are also important, but they will happen one way or the other. The feeding issue, you can actually change the trajectory very, very much.
Yeah. And I think it's so important to make sure that parents are a part of that work in defining what outcomes matter to them. Because I think, and we've seen that, I think, globally too, in just feeding in general, with like the focus used to be like getting off the tube or like volume or some of those things. And there's been, minimal shifts to that.
Yeah.
So in terms of parents as partners in research, would love for you to share a little bit more about that group in general, just because it's nice to expose our audience to that, because our audience is used to hearing Haley and I talk about our person and family centered feeding research consortium, which is a newer group, but they're so amazing. But they're a self-governing group that really participates in research and leads research. And they just published their priorities on where they want to see PFD and ARFID research go. And it's I feel like you all have been such a leader in how to have a partnership with parents and caregivers.
So it is a it's also nice and longer story. So I mentioned in the beginning, our center is called CanChild. And people usually associate CanChild with Canada because we're in Canada. But the name was actually proposed by a mother of a patient and a study participant that said, well, we should focus on what children can do and not only what they cannot do. And that's the double meaning of CanChild. We will focus on the strengths
of
what children is. Yeah. And that was over 30 years ago. So the philosophy of involving parents as partners is it's in our DNA. And our website as well is strives to provide information that is easily accessible. So noise translation was something we did before the term existed even. And what we are proud and known now for is the operationalization of facilitating that collaboration between, or that partnership between parent researchers and academic researchers. And a colleague of ours and two parents developed what is called the Family Engagement in Research Program, which is a micro-credential course at McMaster that is offered virtually. It's online sessions. And the neat thing about that is you will find there are several online materials about how to partner with parents and how to do that. But this is a course where they actually put small groups together, groups of 6-7 people. Half of them are researchers, half of them are parents or parent partners. And they learn from each other. So they learn, how do I engage parents appropriately? How do I avoid that tokenism of just having a parent on the board and nodding that everything is fine? And the parents also get an understanding, okay, what are the constraints for researchers? How do they have to submit grant proposals? And how many do you have to submit until you get one funded? And, and the difficulty of funding, but then also the importance of building into the funding budget money to pay the parent partners, because they are not paid for that work. They're doing that mostly on their free time.
They
should be paid for that. So all these aspects are discussed in that course. So there are online lecture sessions, but then each group develops some small project where they collaborate on a topic that they choose. And that is just taking off. So this program has been used in different US locations, in Australia, in the Netherlands, in Croatia. So if your community is interested in doing that,
I saw Haley's eyes perk up.
That would be a great opportunity, I think.
It's amazing, Olaf. It's huge.
Yeah. And for external signaling how we value that aspect of parent partners in CanChild. So CanChild is it's more like a network. So we have only 4 staff members, but then we have scientists and associate members both here at McMaster University and then also from other countries and other universities. And I think 2 years ago, we decided that the people that work with us that are not linked to an academic center are equivalent to academics. And we have so associate members that are parent researchers or clinician researchers that are, like, we collaborate with many clinicians that work in a treatment center or in their practice, but are engaged and interested in research. They give us ideas. They ask us hard questions. They collaborate with us. They recruit with us. So it is really a partnership at eye level.
I think that's great. Thank you for sharing. The other thing that I wanted to talk about before we let you go, Olav, was the work that you're doing to get the feeding screening tool, so the infant and child feeding questionnaire, into some of the healthcare infrastructure with where you're at. Maybe do you want to share a little bit about that work too? Because I feel like it's you're such a thought leader in that, and I think that a lot of people can maybe think about it differently based on what you are doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So first of all, thank you to Feeding Matters to allow us to use the tool. That was really helpful. And we, so for the study that I mentioned for the neonatal follow-up clinic, they do ask questions about feeding. They have people involved in that aspect already, but we wanted to do it in a more standardized way. And we didn't want to have a separate documentation to be done on the side with all the other documentation you have to do anyway. So then we connected with a hospital in Alberta, also in Canada, that already is using this questionnaire and has embedded it into Epic. And we also use Epic as our electronic health record system and are now, I think it's almost done now, to embed it into our Epic. So we will have it in our electronic health records, and then doing these consults, this can be documented directly in the chart of the patient. And that will make it easier for us to document. And we also have a larger hospital-wide initiative, which is called the Learning Health System, where we try to combine or make it easier to extract clinical data for research purposes. So that is an integration between research and clinical care. And I think that's very important to not duplicate stuff, right? Often you have a clinical system working and you do a lot of things that you need to do clinically, and then you add on research, and that is very difficult for many frontline workers. Well, how do I do that now? And if it's integrated in the workflow, it is much better and easier and more efficient.
Is there any question that I didn't ask of you that you wanted to share? And then maybe Haley can share our last question, because I feel like you're the perfect person to answer.
No, I think it was exciting to talk with you guys. And
I've been so glad to meet you and finally get to hear you speak about the ICF. This has been a pleasure. Well, and actually, I wanted to go back and just ask a question too. Like, what would be different about the PFD model in general if they hadn't used the ICF to conceptualize that?
So I think what we put in the paper is that it is an umbrella term. And I think you would not have that umbrella. You would have a lot of different sub-diagnoses independently from each subspecialty. So the gastroenterologist would have one diagnosis, the development pediatrician would have one diagnosis, and so on. And everybody would just look at like the picture of the philosophers and the elephant, and everybody looks at one piece, right? And sees that it's completely correct and knows everything about that piece, but doesn't see the big picture. And I think that's what we get with the PFD umbrella term.
I think it was the ultimate connector.
I think yeah.
Yeah. So what do you see as some of the main barriers to conducting family-centered research in pediatric feeding disorder, and what are some things you think we can do to overcome them?
Well, I think first parents need to know that they're welcome. I think we need to do a better job in expressing that. Hey, we want you on board. I think that is important. It is important also to validate that they have their limitations. to collaborate. So we need to have flexibility with timing when we set meetings, when we discuss things. It has probably also to be sometimes outside of our working hours and not only the parents' working hours. And then I think we need really to have a research environment that values that contribution as really meaningful and important. And that means also dollars for that work that is being contributed.
That it's work. Yeah. Completely agree.
I agree too. I knew you'd have a great answer to it, Olaf. Well, thank you so much for all that you do in your own world and for coming on and sharing that with us and just sharing your perspective and in such an accessible format. I think it's really helpful to be able to talk about the ICF and kind of the historical roots of that within PFD and what does it mean for how we think about evaluation, assessment, and management right now.
Hey, Charlie.
Well, luckily we all love kids.
Yeah. And that is part, like, in our, when we do partner with parents, that is the norm, right? We have the kids there as well. And we do partner with kids as well now. We have a study with youth partners. Yeah.
Yes.
We have youth partners. Yeah.
Oh, well, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'll just keep everybody updated on your progression and would love to have you on again. But thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for reaching out and always keeping in contact with us. Happy to help in any way I can.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye. And bye, Charlie.